Today's KPR Presents was originally broadcast on May 15, 2016. Former ambassador to South Africa. Before that, director of National Public Radio. Graduate of the University of Kansas and Washburn University. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, Delano Lewis and the power of education to transform lives. Lewis was born in Arkansas City and grew up in Kansas City, where he attended Sumner Academy. He's the author of the autobiographical motivational book, It All Begins With Self. He returned to Kansas City to speak at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center on April 27, 2016, where he was introduced by KU Chancellor Bernadette Gray Little.
Ambassador Lewis served as ambassador to South Africa from 1999 to 2001, having been appointed by President Clinton, and he received KU's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Citation, in 1994. In addition to his service as ambassador, he has worked in a number of other positions in global, corporate, and public affairs. He has worked in the U.S. Department of Justice and in the Peace Corps in Nigeria and Uganda. He has served on many corporate boards, including Apple, Black Entertainment Television, and Colgate-Palmolive. And just to add a little bit more to the range of service and work, I just heard from Dr. Menninger this evening that while he was in law school, he supported himself by working at the Menninger Clinic, working with children. Again, a way in which he learned and which he provided service. The ambassador's career lends itself very well to tonight's topic, the transformational power of education. It is something that I believe in absolutely and am dedicated to, and I look forward very much to hearing your thoughts. Please welcome Ambassador Lewis.
Good evening. Real pleasure. Thank you to Chancellor for that beautiful, wonderful introduction. It's quite an honor to have the Chancellor of my alma mater to introduce me, because I have such great memories of the university. And I could say to you, Chancellor Gray Little, that when my book is entitled It All Begins With Self, but I can probably change that by saying to you that it all began at KU, because that's where I met Gail Lewis, and she's here tonight, and we will be celebrating. We were met at KU. We have some very fond memories of the University of Kansas. We married right after graduation. I went on to Washburn, as you noted, and we've been married. We'll be married 56 years this coming June. So it all began there, and we're proud to say we have four adult sons and 11 grandchildren, so we are very blessed. But I want to thank Kauffman Foundation for this gracious invitation to share some thoughts with you tonight on education. I must say some acknowledge to Seren Ducha. He's a senior fellow here at Kauffman, and he was the one who had the idea that we ought to bring Delano back home, and Kauffman ought to be involved. And so he started that ball rolling, and this invitation happened, and I want to thank to Seren that we met on a plane not too long ago. And Gail says, always, I'll talk to anybody, not that you're anybody, Seren. But we were in first class together, and we just hit it off and spent a great time traveling from San Diego to New York. And so he's a dear friend, a great business person, and we have become very good friends from that conversation, and he's been very active with Kauffman. But before I give my remarks, I have to say this front row is a very distinguished front row, and there are some Sumner classmates here, and I won't start telling names because I'll miss the classmates, but it's always great to see my class, 1956, and glad for them to come to support me. But this front row here is made up of some very important relatives, and I'm just pleased that they're here. You mentioned Dr. Menninger, Walt Menninger. We have become friends, better friends. I was a child care worker at the Menninger Clinic when I was in law school, and I work 40 hours a week, and we have a lot of to thank Miniger about, because that paid the rent and kept us together and provided us a great understanding of people. And I was also very honored when Miniger's asked me, after they had moved from Topeka to Houston, and Dr. Wald had asked me if I would be the keynote speaker for the opening of their facilities in Houston. So I was quite honored to go from a child care worker to being a keynote speaker at the opening of the facilities in Houston. But I have to go down the line to talk about the new sheriff in Shawnee County. He probably isn't so new. Herman Jones is my cousin, and he was elected sheriff of Shawnee County. I'm very proud of him, and I know he's doing a fine job of law enforcement in Shawnee County, and I'm always on my P's and Q's when I'm going through the area. But I'm so pleased that my family is here. I want to share with you some thoughts about education and about my background and leave some thoughts for you to think about. I grew up, born in Arkansas City, Kansas, but grew up in Kansas City, Kansas. My dad came here to find a job, and he found a job on the Santa Fe Railroad. And he spent 37 years on the Santa Fe Railroad. And I grew up on trains, and I love trains to this day. My mother was a domestic, and she was a high school graduate, and she ended up becoming a cosmetologist before she passed on. My dad just passed not too long ago at age 87 after 37 years on the Santa Fe. But as an only child, my family gave me everything they could. I must tell you that I didn't want for much as an only child. My parents paid for my tuition at the University of Kansas. They paid for my law school tuition, and I told Dad if he would do that, even after I was married, I would take care of everything else. And thanks to Miniger's, we were able to do that. But I tell you that starting out because education doesn't happen in a vacuum. Education happens when you got support of people who love and care for you and appoint you in those directions. When I spoke to students of the charter school today, I talked to them about keeping college on their mind, but I also talked about ways of having people support you to get there. So I was growing up in a segregated Kansas City. I was saying that the streetcar that you're going to have going down Main Street, in my day, the streetcar was a mode of transportation to get from Kansas side to the Missouri side. I went to the only black high school in the state of Kansas. That was Sumner High School, and my classmates will testify to that. It was one of the best schools in the state because we had teachers who were African-American working on their master's and their PhDs who couldn't find jobs elsewhere because of racial discrimination, and they taught at Sumner. We had some of the best teachers we could ever find. So the educational foundation of Sumner was absolutely superior to most. I always remember that, and it's true today. It became an academy, and the principal of the Sumner Academy is here tonight. It became an academy in 1978, and is still carrying on that tradition of excellence. And he told me the Washington Post just named them one of the best schools in the nation for academic achievement. So that is still going on today. But it was a black school in those days. The elementary schools were segregated. The high schools were integrated around Kansas. My cousins in southern Kansas were in integrated schools. But I, up in Kansas City, went to the only black high school. You know, Linda Brown tried to get into the elementary school in Topeka, and that was the Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka in 1954. And as one of my classmates will tell you, we graduated in 56. We had one white student with us who graduated with us in 1956. So it was a segregated environment. It was a very limiting environment. We couldn't go to the shows on Minnesota Avenue. The Avenue, the Grand, those shows, the Electric Theater on the Minnesota. We could not go to those theaters, or after a while we could go to those theaters, but we had to sit in a certain section. There was the Regal Theater on 10th Street, and I lived near the Regal Theater, and then there was the Princess Theater on 5th Street. Those were the theaters for blacks. So this was the environment that we lived in, and it was a nurturing environment in many ways because we had a strong neighborhood component. You knew people in that neighborhood by the churches they attended, by the schools that they attended, whether it was elementary school at Douglas or Grant, or whether it's Northeast Junior High School, which is the middle school, or was it Sumner High School. You all knew the people who lived and worked and worshiped in those few blocks radius, from 5th Street or 3rd Street to 12th or 13th Street and Quindaro to Minnesota, all in one square area. But it was a nurturing neighborhood. Not only did you have teachers that would help and support you, you would see them at church on Sunday, and they would also be telling you what you should be thinking about for the future. So you had that kind of environment in Kansas City, Kansas. I remember getting on the streetcar to go to the Mabel Williams School of Dance in Kansas City, Missouri, and it was a dance school, and I was a tap dancer. And I would get on the streetcar to go to Mabel Williams to take my dancing lessons because my mother thought that I should have some cultural kind of underpinnings. I played violin in elementary school, played trumpet in the high school band, drum major of the band. So I had that kind of environment of excelling and also having culture and those kinds of things that I was exposed to. So I say all that to you is that it was not an easy place, but it had a lot of positives in terms of our growing up. But one last story about that growing up, I was appointed by my principal, Sol Thompson, along with a classmate, Dan Matthews, to be representatives from Sumner to Boy State in 1955. And Boy State was in Wichita, Kansas, and it's still going on today. It's American Legion Program of Government in Action. And they have Girl State as well. And Boy State, you set up local government, you set up state government, county government, you run for office. There were 500 boys from all over the state, and there were very few African Americans or other minorities at that time in 1955. And I remember going there, and I'm going to be competing with these kids, and I had not had that kind of interaction before as an African-American with people of other races or other parts of Kansas, nevertheless. And I had this feeling that, could I measure up? That was sort of a nagging feeling. But once I hit Boy State, I hit my stride. Self-confidence began to develop. I ran for office. I became one of the 7 Supreme Court justices. I was drum major of the Boy State Band. It did more for my confidence as a junior. I went back to Boy State as a counselor. I was back in Boy State just a few years ago after being there 50 years ago, and I spoke to the Boy State group, and that session was in Manhattan because it had such a tremendous impact on me. So when you read the book, It All Begins With Self, it talks about having self-confidence. So the students that are in the audience today, those who are moving forward or thinking about their careers, it all begins with you and your ability and feelings about good about yourself. And that's all started for me from Boy State. So I came back. I knew I was going to college. And I was just reminiscing the other day, thinking about 60 years ago when we graduated from Sumner, I was one of the 3 commencement speakers. Joanna Featherston, Dan Matthews, and I were the 3 student speakers at our commencement in Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas. Some of those things keep coming back. But those were the opportunities that I got by that school and by those mentors that gave me this vision that I could succeed. So in my yearbook, you will see a picture that doesn't look like me now, but a picture that says I was a part of the National Honor Society, I was drum major of the band, I was a part of an international club, and it had ambition, lawyer. So I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, and I knew I wanted to work in civil rights, but I took lots of different turns in my career, but I had that underpinning, that strong underpinning at Sumner. To discuss this with you, I'm reminded of the vision of Mr. Kaufman, Ewan Marion Kaufman. Because as I was thinking about my career and thinking about the background that I just shared with you, just some of it, I was reminded of his vision. And I've read a lot about him in preparation for being here today. And it was very clear in his mind. He said, education would assist those who find themselves facing economic inequalities, find them facing racial issues. Education is an answer. So his vision was to begin to right that ship and giving people the educational opportunities to deal with many inequities of our society. And what you're seeing around in this beautiful building, what I saw at the charter school today, what I've seen in the Kaufman scholars that I've read about, and I'm one Kaufman scholar we're going to be talking to later, you see this legacy of Mr. Kaufman. that he's still speaking to us today through these students. And over the charter school, you could feel it, that they're on their way to college. The fact that there are rooms of learning in middle school and they're starting in ninth grade, the schools, the rooms are based around colleges. There is a KU classroom. So that a student going there to study their math, they're going into the KU classroom. So I'm sure many of the other classrooms were named for universities. So you get the in your mindset that you were going to college. Many of us that graduated from Sumner in my years knew that the education was a way out of poverty, a way out of the situations that we felt were discriminatory. Education was the way. And so Mr. Kaufman's vision was there. I also was reminded, as I thought about my life and his vision, was his project called Project Choice. And it was a fascinating story if you've not read it. It was a program that he started in 1988. And he announced it at a meeting of mostly African-American kids and their parents. And he said, I want you to think about going to college. And if you think about going, you can sign up and I will pay your way to college. And someone said, well, what's the catch, Mr. Kaufman? He said, the catch is you're gonna have to sign a contract and your parents are gonna have to sign a contract. And the contract will be that you will stay in school in high school, that you will have passing grades, that you will stay out of difficulty with the law, that you will avoid parenthood, and that you will work toward graduating from college. You will abstain from alcohol and drugs. That's the contract that you will sign. And your parents will sign a contract that will say that they will support you in your efforts, that they'll work in the high school and support you with activities at the school. So the parents sign the contract that they would be involved in support. He also found in this project that he's going to need to help these kids. So they started remedial programs. They started tutoring programs, all to give those kids the kind of support they needed to graduate. Mr. Kaufman appointed an African-American to lead this program. And this person, Mr. Thomas Roan, took over as director of Project Choice. Thomas Roan was a teacher and a coach at Sumner High School. He was there as a teacher and a coach when I was there. He went on to become principal of Wyandotte High School. He went on to work for Mr. Kaufman in Marion Laboratories. And you can see very clearly that Mr. Kaufman was a mentor to Thomas Roan. And Thomas Roan became the director in 1988 of Project Choice. And I want to say to you that he started this program at Westport Middle School, eighth grade. Community was predominantly African American, low income, problems with violence, problems with drugs. That's where he started this program. And these people signed up, and eventually he had some people, students sign up from Kansas. Just some brief notes about the program. It went from 1988 to 2001. The program completed in 2001. 1,394 who signed agreements with Dr. Kaufman, 628 went on, graduated from high school, went on to college. 87 went to vocational, technical, or business schools. Pretty good record. Over 50% of those he started and signed up, over 50% went on after finishing high school, went on to college. And then, after that program was completed, it laid the foundation for Kaufman Scholars. And Kaufman Scholars is an exciting program going on today. But what they did was the lessons learned from Project Choice. One lesson was inner city kids could succeed. That the caring adults around them was even more important than the incentive to go to school. That support services to support them to succeed were absolutely critical. When Gail chaired the Foundation Schools in the Washington, D.C. area, It was a very different kind of alternative schools. Kids who had difficulties went to this school. She chaired its board. They had a similar idea of what they call wraparound services. The same thing that Dr. Kaufman had in Project Choice. The same thing that they have today in the Kaufman Scholars. They have tutoring programs. They have remedial programs. They have the kind of support to say, if you need help, we're going to make you get from step A to step B. Absolutely critical. So I'm reminded of the similarities of my caring neighborhood in Kansas, my strong support from my family and relatives, my strong support from the church that I attended, my strong support from my high school. Those kinds of things aided my success. There was no doubt I was going to college. There was no doubt I was going to University of Kansas. There was no doubt I was going to pledge Alpha Phi Alpha. And the reason was I had those role models at Sumner High School. My band teacher went to KU. My science teacher went to KU. My chemistry teacher went to KU. And most of them pledged and became members of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. There was no doubt where I was going, and there was no doubt what fraternity I was going to follow, because those men gave me the path. Extraordinary men, from the principal down, and not just men teachers, but women teachers. And Elaine is there. She'll remember Mrs. Bloodworth, who taught us English, and we learned English. Mrs. Penman, Mrs. Haley, who taught me speech. I will not forget. Mrs. Fortenberry, who taught me Spanish. I will not forget. Mr. Clark, my band teacher, was a real mentor. So I'm reminded of the similarities of my life and the similarities of what Dr. Kaufman put together with Project Choice and what he put together with the Kaufman Scholars. So as we celebrate the 100th year of Ewan Marion Kaufman's birth from 1916 to 2016, we know that his mission is relevant today. We know, unfortunately, that we still have issues of race. We know, unfortunately, we still have gender issues. We still know we have discrimination between people who are gay in our society. We still know that we have these issues. But we also know that education and information and collaboration and understanding will be the way to deal with those issues. So his message today is quite relevant. His mission today is quite relevant. That not only do you have schools that cater and support these children, but you have to get services that give them the support they need in order to succeed. That neighborhood support, that tutoring support, that focus that they can succeed. So when you read my book, I talk a lot about beginning with self. I talk about self-confidence. I talk about doing a self-assessment of who you are, having a sense of what you'd like to be, and having a focus and a game plan on getting it done. And you get it done by getting the skills training. I was fortunate enough to get it from Sumner, from KU, from Washburn, and I got it from 35 years of work. 10 years in the federal government, as you've heard, 21 years in private business, 5 years in the not-for-profit with National Public Radio, and almost 2 years or so in the diplomatic world. And after coming back and moving to New Mexico, I went into academia. And Chancellor, we need to talk about that. I had not seen politics so fierce than the politics of academe. So I helped to start an international relations institute at New Mexico State, but that was quite an interesting experience at New Mexico State. But I'm going to conclude by speaking directly to parents, students, community leaders, business leaders. You've heard about the African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child, and it does. That proverb talks about all the things necessary to raise that child. It is the wraparound services that are needed. That it's just not the parents or the grandparents or the grandmother or the aunt or the uncle or the guardian, but it's the pastor in a community. It's the relatives in the community. It's the business leaders in the community. It's all of those people who believe that if we don't invest in our community, we will not get the returns necessary for our communities to grow and to prosper. And that growth is within humans and human capital. So I speak to all of you in terms of being a citizen of a community, a business in a community, a not-for-profit in the community, a foundation in the community. And Dr. Kaufman and Mr. Kaufman understood his role. And this staff talks about what they do with their grants and how they leverage it. But the focus is making life better for this community and other communities in the region. And now I'd like to conclude by some message directly to students. Because we're blessed with 4 adult sons and 11 grandchildren, 6 grandsons and 5 granddaughters, and the way we communicate with them now is through text. And email is even passe. It's, if we want to get to them quick, it's a text. It's whether we're on Twitter or whatever, Gail and I are trying to keep up with those grandchildren. But we're learning from them. We're learning a great deal from them. And I talk about and listen to them. One of the things adults don't do too well, and that's to listen. But to listen to them. But we have a responsibility to listen and to learn, all of us in this community. And lastly, I want to talk directly to the students. Because what Mr. Kaufman has done, from Project Choice to the Kaufman Scholars, to the school, to the grants that he makes across the board, it's all about making life better for those who need it. And the students have to respond. And I'm saying to you as students, and those of you who think you need it, you start with self. You start getting a sense of who you are, an identity and a self-confidence that you too can achieve. And with that comes a belief in oneself. You can't pass that math exam or that biology exam if you feel you're going to fail. You've got to have this confidence that you're going to succeed. Yes, there are going to be obstacles in a way, but you're going to surmount those obstacles because you have belief in yourself. Along with that comes hard work and perseverance. There's no question about it. You work hard. And you develop the skills necessary. So when those doors open, you're able to walk in and take advantage. Those things that you heard about my resume didn't happen because I'm so smart. It didn't happen because it was me. It happened because of family, of a loving spouse and partner, and above all, mentors who believed in me because they saw that I believed in myself. So you too can succeed as a student, but you have to set your sights high. I say to students, why do you model yourself after people who fail? You model yourself after people who succeed, and you find out how they did it. And that's why I wrote the book. The book is a 77-page quick how-to book. It tells you, with my life experiences, how I did it. And I didn't do it alone. You'll see in the book that there are mentors along the way. I didn't become president of the company, operating company of CNP Telephone, if it had not been for the mentor, Ralph Frey, who set me by his office for 6 years and to help me learn telecommunications. And when he retired, I took his job. So, number one, a sense of self, a belief in self, a sense that you too can succeed, strong focus, perseverance. And I must say to you that think beyond your horizons, think beyond your community, think globally. Take that trip abroad. Do study abroad. Travel. Learn about people in other lands, other cultures, other languages, other religions, because that's going to expand your horizons. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we live in a global society. So if you want to learn languages, Spanish, French, German, Portuguese, how about Mandarin? Think about what the future holds and take advantage of it, because we're all global citizens. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Delano Lewis, former ambassador to South Africa and former director of National Public Radio. Lewis spoke on the transformational power of education at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center in Kansas City on April 27, 2016. He now takes questions from Kauffman scholar Maya Tillman and from the audience.
When was the first time you started to really think globally about leadership?
When was the first time I thought globally about leadership? And I think it was our Peace Corps experience. I talk about it in the book, about sometimes you have to move outside your comfort zone. And I wanted to be a lawyer, and I did that, and I wanted to work in civil rights. And the second job I had in government was with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, dealing with employment discrimination. So I was in the civil rights arena. And this opportunity came about that we could go to the Peace Corps. And I thought this would be for people that were not married and no children or whatever. And I could found out I could go as Peace Corps staff and could take my family. And so we went to Nigeria with my wife and I and three boys, 5, 3, and 2, ended up in Uganda. And we had a fourth child born in Uganda. That's when I got the chance to see a part of the world. We traveled around Africa. We traveled some in Europe. I got a sense to see the world. So I got to think and understand a little bit about our global society. And since that time, I've been in the corporate world. I've had a chance to travel again to China and to other places in Asia and also to Latin America as well. And so I've seen a lot about global society. So I guess it all started with Peace Corps. And now Peace Corps is still going on today, started in 1962. It is still very strong. They're looking now more for, in those years, they were looking for generalists. So if you had an AB degree, you know, they'd take you in a minute. Now they're looking to have people that have more specialized skills. But it's still a very strong, viable group. Go as a volunteer, it's an amazing 2-year stint. And Peace Corps staff is just, was great for us.
Mr. Ambassador, could you talk about your time at National Public Radio?
Yes, it was a very interesting time. Just quickly, this was 1994, and the NPR board was looking for a president, a new president, and they went out on a national search, and they hired an executive search firm. And the executive search basically said they were looking for a non-journalist. They've had several presidents that had been journalists. They wanted a person that had business experience. They wanted a person that had some not-for-profit experience. So it really was interesting, but I didn't know anything about what they were looking for until I got a call from the headhunter. And the executive search person said, I'm working for this firm, and I'm looking for a president of National Public Radio. That's my client. I'd like to take you to lunch. And I said, why do you want to take me to lunch? He said, well, I've been in this Washington community for a long time. I worked for the Carter White House at one point. I've watched your career, and I want to talk to you about NPR. Now, again, a couple lessons here. You never know who's watching you. You never know who knows you and what you're doing. And so that's how I got the call. So I did go into NPR. There were some 200 applicants. Ended up with two of us, and I ended up getting the nod. My time was interesting because it's a fabulous organization with very experienced, talented journalists who didn't want to be managed. And they were very, very suspicious of a business person. And so I came from a different culture. And that's also in my book. How do you survive when you're in a different culture or culture that doesn't you don't think you really fit? Because all organizations have culture. So I had to realize that this was a very different culture than I had been most recently, the business world. And I had to step back after talking to the chairman of the board and get some advice from him, because I wasn't sure this job was for me. So the chairman came in, he was a station manager, and he came in to Washington, we spent time together, and he talked to me about the history of NPR and the organization. So long answer to your question is that I began to understand the culture, I began to step back from my business hat, I began to listen more carefully to the managers there, and I began to become much more involved in making my ideas have fruition. And it began to work. One of the main challenges I had was trying to get them to see that we need to look beyond what we've been doing for the last few years. We need to think about competition. We need to think about new technologies. This is 1994. We need to think about our listenership if we're going to survive. Listenership was 55 years plus. All of those things, I think, were what a president should be talking about. But they were very much on this ivory tower of providing, and they did, very good journalism. And they didn't really want to face these realities. So it was not easy, but I began to make some of my points stick. I made some changes, and I decided that maybe 5 years was about my limit.
We've probably talked about it, but I find it very interesting by being the ambassador of South Africa. Could you tell us a little bit, one of your greatest takes from meeting Mandela?
Thank you for the question. It was one of the joys of my life on many occasions. I presented my credentials to the president of the country, Thabo Mbeki, in January 2000. And that was a momentous occasion to present my credentials to him and to take over the ambassadorship. And then I had to pay a call on Nelson Mandela because he was the former president. And it was just a great experience. I mean, you feel you're in the presence of royalty. I mean, he exudes a kind of elegance and humility. His leadership speaks for itself, but he's such a humble man. So it was just a wonderful time. And then I had many other times to talk with him about various issues. And one time I thought, I'll give you two stories. Once was I thought I'd have a very short visit with the president. So we drove to his office, which was at his residence. And Gail was there in the car along with Gail's sister and two of my grandsons. And they were about maybe 9 or 11, something of that sort. So I thought I would go in and do my business with the president, Mr. Mandela, and then we'd be on our way. So as we were walking out of his foyer, getting ready to go out after our session, and he said, "Mr. Ambassador, how is the family?" I said, "The family is fine. They're in the car." He said, "In the car?" He said, "What are they doing in the car? Bring them in." So we all went in and we had tea, and he turned to my grandsons and he said, "Do you know that your grandfather is an important man?" For me to have Nelson Mandela say that I was an important man, and he said, "Yes, he is the United States ambassador to my country. He is a very important man." That's one story. The other story was, as we were leaving, Gail and I wondered if we could get Mr. Mandela to sign his book for our four sons and their families. So that would be four books and autograph them. So we contacted his assistant, and she, you know, it was hard to get him to see the president. I mean, she was tough. But I was able to get to her, and I asked her, "Do you think he would do this? Do you think he would sign this for my sons and their families?" She said, "Sure. Bring the books in." So we had typed it up with all their names and so forth. And what happened by sitting there and he's writing it, he said, "Oh, that the oldest son is Dell. Okay, Dell. Tell me about Dell. Tell me about what he's doing. And so each one that he signed, he wanted to know about the family. He wanted to know about our kids. And it was just a marvelous experience. And so if you go to any one of our houses, and you've probably been to some of the houses, you'll see on the coffee table the Long Walk for Freedom, the book signed by Nelson Mandela to each of our kids.
What advice would you give a young Black professional transitioning into the working world where the majority of their coworkers and superiors do not look like them?
Well, that's beginning to change in our society, particularly among the Hispanic community, because I think the minority community generally, which would include Hispanics, African Americans, and Asians, and Native Americans, our society is moving toward a majority-minority. But your question basically is, in many situations, you're in groups that your superiors and your colleagues don't look like you. The answer is just have a sense of direction and focus. You're there, whatever it is, to do a job, and you need to do it well. If you're interested in moving up, you got to figure out how to do that. And you may find that some people are jealous of you, or some people are prejudiced. That's sort of life. You'll figure that out, and you'll find ways, you should find ways, to handle that. And one of the best ways to handle it is, no one can criticize you for the job that you do. That you are the best at what you do. You show value to the company. You show value to the organization. Your skills are there. You're there on time. You dress well. You behave sensibly. So who's going to criticize? The person that criticizes because they don't like the color of your skin, that's their problem. You keep your eye on the ball. Do not use race as an excuse. Yes, it's there. You have to meet it sometimes head on. And there are ways to do that peaceably and sensibly. But what you do is you keep moving forward. And you connect with people, regardless of their color. You connect. Learn how the system works, and you connect. And by doing that, you will show that I'm a person that values what I'm doing, and you value me, and we'll work it together. Not to deny your identity. You know, you certainly can be a strong minority, strong African-American woman or man, but at the same time, understanding where you fit in this equation. In other words, you in control. You're in control.
So kind of going off of that, how did you persevere through the adversity of being one of the only minorities in the judiciary in the 1960s in Washington, D.C.?
Interesting question. The only thing I'd ask is that you're right on one score, but I want to be very clear about the answer to the question. I was in the Justice Department, and so I'll give a little civics lesson right away. The Justice Department is in the executive branch, and the judiciary is the judicial system, which includes the courts. And I've not been a practicing lawyer, so I was not in the judiciary per se, but I was in the Justice Department. And it was first of all, I was honored to be there. It was my first job after the Menninger Foundation. I left law school. I kept the job at Menninger's, and thank goodness I had that job, Dr. Walt. And then the offer came from the Department of Justice. And when I got there, I had not been to Washington, D.C. before. I went first, and then my family came later. But I was in Internal Security Division. And this was a division that was looking for espionage and people who were violating our espionage laws. And so it was a very interesting time. I did find out after being there a short time that out of 1,000 or so lawyers, there were probably about 10 African Americans. So there were not that many Black lawyers at Justice at that time. You know, when you say, how do I feel about it, or how did I feel about it, I knew that was a fact, but I just felt that somewhere along the line, if I did my job well, and other African Americans did their job well, and we work at our society, there's going to be change, and there'll be more of us in the Justice Department. So I didn't feel I needed to take it on. I didn't have the time to take it on as a charge, but I figured that if I did my job well, I would be one of those that would lend itself to saying, see, we can hire these folks and they can do the job. So that's how I approached it. And over time, I've seen change, but I must say to you today, I'm very worried because we seem to have reversed. We seem to slide back some on our bringing minorities in on many levels, and that worries me a bit. We were making great strides in this country in terms of diversity and in terms of equality, but in the last few years, I'm seeing that we still have some issues and some mountains to climb.
Thank you, Ambassador. A lot of the points that you talked about really hit home for me. I'm a graduate of Sumner Academy. I'm a Project Choice scholar, I guess is the best term for it. And I spent the last 15 years or so as a university administrator in international education. One thing, like you, that I'm very discouraged by is the rhetoric around trade with other countries. When I hear the candidates talk about that being an issue, it hurts me because I spend my life encouraging people to step outside of themselves in the United States. And trade, as controversial as it is, I see that as a way for us to encounter people from places that we would never encounter. And with the advent of the internet, we have a lot of changes, positive changes, as a result of globalization. So as you hear this rhetoric, how do you respond to people who are retreating more into an isolationist view of the world?
I think that's a dangerous trend, and I'm certainly would be opposed to an isolationist philosophy. Personally believe that we are global citizens and that we need to understand the economics of the world. If not, we're going to be left behind. So I think it's very short-sighted. Having said that, I think you still understand politics is politics and that people have every right to speak their minds. And obviously, we relate to politicians and we relate to our leaders personally, as to things that are affecting us. And that if I'm an unemployed worker and I see a person who comes in who doesn't look like me and probably, I'm out of a job and this person is working, then some politician says that we need to keep all immigrants out of the country, I'd support him because that immigrant, quote, took my job. So there are some personal things here that, you know, we have to understand and keep in mind. As in a philosophy, I think it's a dangerous trend. For trade agreements, I think I'm definitely pro-trade agreements. I believe that the business world, the trading between countries makes some sense for this country economically, and we can talk about specifics. But the thing that's lost among our politicians and among our discourse generally is a one simple word of balance. There's another word too, compromise. That if you have some positions that make sense, but you hear views that are different, it seems to me we ought to be in more dialogue with each other to figure out what the balance is. What's the compromise? What is the win-win? We don't do that. It's either or. To me, that's very dangerous. To me, we get nothing done. There are no results. So I'm definitely with you on a philosophy of knowing what the world is outside. And if you don't know, you talk to our grandchildren, they've already had experiences. One of my grandsons has been to, he's been to Costa Rica, he's been to the Dominican Republic. It's just amazing. And that was when he was in high school. And he's at a charter school in California. So there's some sense here that there's an old world out there that we need to know and understand.
And then going off of what you were saying earlier about having a family and like the great support system, I do have a question for your wife, Mrs. Lewis. In your opinion, like, what makes a family successful? And then why is a strong family important to a successful life and career?
First, let me give a little definition, my definition of family. And family includes anyone and everyone around you who participates in your human growth and development and well-being. And you can make your family very, very large. We eventually become the family of the world. But what makes it successful is being honest with ourselves and with each other. And being honest, you let everyone who cares about you know what you need, and you stay open to listen to the needs of the other members of your family. And you're supportive. I've learned after all these years that, this is very trite, but problems come and you get over them. You'll get over a lot of things if you just make up your mind that it's worth getting over and it's worth going forward. Just continued love and support and lack of harsh judgment on everyone in a part of the family. And then recognize yourself as a member of the family and enjoy it and appreciate it and celebrate it.
Okay, next question.
Yes, sir. I'm just looking at the book and it says all begins with self. So I want to ask a question. And I know it's, you got a couple folks that thrive no matter what situation you put them in. But for the masses, for minorities, how do you get them to believe in themselves when the system is set up for them not to? So my question, I guess, is how do we teach that to the masses to believe in you?
Could I take issue with you just a bit?
Go ahead.
I never believed the system was built against me.
Okay.
I believe that the system had some good points, it had some bad points. I believe strongly in our Constitution. I believe strongly in our form of government. It's got some frailties. But I never had the sense that it was set up against me. Now, I did know that we have the legacy of slavery, and many of the signers of that document were slave owners. So I have some questions there. But the document to me that says freedoms and protections for freedoms, and the system is one which I worked through, and I didn't have the mindset that it was built against me. So that's the mindset. So going into a situation, when she asked about going into a situation with the Justice Department, when I was one of the few minorities there, it all depends upon how you handle the situation. And how do you convince people? And you say, how to get them to have belief and trust in themselves. First of all, is an attitude up here about who you are and what you're about, and how I can convince my family that, you know, this attitude will work, and that's a positive attitude, that if I work hard, yes, we know there's some inequities in the system. I mean, we hear all the political candidates saying it's all rigged, and it may be against us. But I'm a warm believer that if I understand the system, if I'm smart enough, I can make it work for me. And so that's the way I approached it. I always felt that I could beat that other person at the game. But I first had to learn how to play the game. And I'm not belittling the question at all. I'm not belittling the fact that it's not easy. It's difficult. But there's an attitude thing here. And if a child is told negatives all its life, they're going to believe those negatives all their lives. If they're told the system is against them and you will never make it, guess what? They probably won't make it. But what if you were told that the system can be for you? Suppose you told them that if you get a a solid education and a skill, you too can do it. What if you told them that hard work will pay off? Now, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I lose the promotion. Sometimes somebody gets promoted over me. Those are realities of life. But I don't lay down. I get up and try it again. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but we had dinner table conversations. And with social media, I don't know whether that's happening today. We had dinner table conversations. Gail and I didn't sit at the front of the table. I sat on one side, she sat on another. There was a child who sat at the youngest who sat at the front of the table. We had our assigned seats. But at the dinner, you could bring up anything you wanted to talk about. And then we talked about, you know, they would talk about when I'm gonna get my own room. You know, very, very straight questions. But they also talked about issues. And we talked about life, and we talked about challenges, we talked about neighbors, and we have some neighbors even sitting at our table for dinner. So, you know, we think we imparted to them that there is a spirit here of family, that we respect you and what you have to say, we're going to listen to you, and we're going to come to some conclusions. So how do you tell people to believe in themselves when the system is against them? Tell them that the system is not always against you. So much of it is how you deal with the system.
Thank you.
You've just heard Delano Lewis, former CEO and president of National Public Radio, former ambassador to South Africa, and author of It All Begins with Self. Lewis spoke on the transformational power of education on April 27, 2016 at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center in Kansas City. Lewis is a graduate of the University of Kansas and Washburn University. In 1994, he received KU's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Citation. Kansas Public Radio has a copy of Delano Lewis's book to give away. If you'd like a chance to win It All Begins With Self, go to our website, kpr.ku.edu, click on Extras, and then Available Giveaways. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu, Extras, and then Available Giveaways. If you've enjoyed today's KPR Presents or have comments or suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. My email address is kmcintyre@ku.edu. That's kmcintyre@ku.edu. Again, that's kmcintyre@ku.edu. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.